Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Tax day is Monday. As last-minute taxpayers file returns, we are going to talk about the U.S. tax system, how it has changed over the years, who pays what share, and where the money goes. Of the 35 richest countries in the world, the United States ranks 32nd in total tax burden. The only countries that pay less are Mexico and Chile. This is according to journalist T.R. Reid. We had him on the show a couple of years ago to talk about his book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. The last 50 years has seen a shift from taxes away from businesses onto individuals. 50 years ago, corporations paid $1.50 in taxes for every dollar individuals paid. Today, corporations pay just 25 cents for every dollar individuals pay. And then there are tax cuts. Since the year 2000, the top 20% of households have received 65% of all tax cuts. That is more than $3.3 trillion in tax cuts, according to Citizens for Tax Justice. The Trump administration's 2017 $1.5 trillion tax cut package gave most benefits to high-income households. It does include benefits for low- and middle-income households, but those provisions will expire at the end of 2025. The law also created a windfall for corporations, and tax collections from corporations are already falling dramatically at a rate never seen during a period of economic growth, according to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. A new report from the Institute found that 60 of the country's most profitable companies did not pay any federal income taxes. The report found that instead of paying $16 billion in taxes, these companies enjoyed a net corporate tax rebate of just over $4 billion. These companies include Amazon and Netflix. To talk more about the report and the taxes, we are joined by Matt Gardner, a senior fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan tax policy organization. Matt previously served as the Institute's executive director from 2006 to 2016, and his work focuses on federal, state, and local tax systems, with an emphasis on the impact of tax policies on low and moderate income taxpayers. Hi, Matt. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Gene Sterley. Gene is Institute Fellow and Richard B. Fisher Chair, as well as the co-founder of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. They provide independent analysis of current and longer-term tax issues. Gene is also the author of Dead Men Ruling, How to Restore Fiscal Freedom and Rescue Our Future. Hi, Gene. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Well, great to have both of you. I just want to start off with a fact that really still strikes me when we interviewed T.R. Reid. And in his book, he wrote that of the world's 35 richest countries, the United States ranks 32nd in total tax burden. And that's one fact that I just still, this still stays with me in that book. Matt, can you talk about that? I mean, we don't hear that much in conversations around taxes. And what does that mean exactly?
Well, when people say that our taxes are low relative to other nations, what they're generally doing is looking at members of the OECD, sort of developed democracies, I guess you could call them, nations that have fully developed safety nets on the spending side and have a fully developed tax system that they use to support that. And yeah, it's been pretty well established for a long time now that when you measure our taxes as a share of the size of our economy, the U.S. is pretty low. There are reasons, many of them rooted in policy, but also rooted, I guess, in the many things that make the United States unique socially, why we don't always think of it that way, and why lots of Americans would swear up and down that it is not the case. But objectively, it's true. Our taxes simply are not that high and never have been.
And why do you think we don't think about it this way? Why doesn't this get more attention?
Well, for one thing, there has been a very well-developed cottage industry for fully 30 years that views government as essentially the enemy and that views all taxes as bad and all spending as bad. I'm overstating a little bit, but there's just this general presumption that taxes don't pay for anything good. If you're starting from that premise, then it doesn't matter how much lower you are than France or Sweden or Germany or anyone. What matters is that it feels too high to you. And I think that anti-government attitude is probably what drives a lot of the opposition here.
Gene, what are your thoughts on this? What would you add?
Well, I guess a couple caveats on those statistics. I think they're correct. They're measuring our revenues as a share of our economy. Our economy is also richer on a per household basis than almost all these other economies. So if you compare in terms of absolute dollars or real dollars, we collect about as much as other countries. And we also share in common with those countries now a common problem across all of the OECD that Matt referred to, which is we refuse to collect enough taxes to pay our bills. And that gets very political. So the bottom line is that in politics, most of us are defined as middle class. Basically, outside of the welfare recipients that the right wants to go after and the very rich that the left is willing to go after, they define the other 98% of us who are voting as the middle class who are either being screwed by somebody on those very tails. But in point of fact, we pay for most of government, those in this broad 95-98% of people. We pay for most of government and we get most of government benefits, but we're constantly sold a bill of goods that we can get essentially something for nothing, more benefits and fewer taxes. And both sides play this game, and that's affecting not only revenue collections, but it's affecting our ability to do much new in our economy these days.
And Gene, let's also talk about the changes that we have seen over the last 50 years, the shift from taxes away from businesses onto individuals. And these numbers I'm getting from the economist Richard Wolff, who repeats this pretty regularly on his podcast. He says that 50 years ago, corporations paid $1.50 in taxes for every dollar that we all pay, that individuals pay. And he says today, corporations pay 25 cents for every dollar that we all pay. Does that sound right to you, Gene?
That's right. That's been a long history. The original income taxes, when they were enacted, even before 50 years ago, back the early part of last century, corporate taxes were enacted even before individual taxes, and individual taxes were mainly assessed only on the very wealthy. Over time, several things happened. One, government got a lot larger. So the expression in World War II was the class tax became a mass tax. And that was under Roosevelt. So basically, the middle class, as I say, has to pay for most of what it gets, and the system became much larger, and that increased significantly the taxes on individuals. There's also been some agreement between left and right that corporations don't pay taxes, individuals do. People care about what corporations pay mainly because they care whether the people who own those corporations are getting a break that they consider fair or unfair. And there has been a movement in this country to reduce significantly the taxes, particularly on returns from capital income. So that's taken place also at the same time. So these various movements, the movements to increase toward a much larger government, as I say, mainly has occurred in World War II and in a few years thereafter, as well as the movement against taxing capital income, tended to reduce the corporate tax. Now, what Matt's probably going to jump in here and say, which is correct, we could have increased the taxes on higher income individuals or higher wealth individuals as an offset to reducing the corporate taxes, but we didn't really do that.
And Matt, we'll talk about the new report from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy in just a minute. But can you talk about this shift? So if 50 years ago, corporations were paying $1.50 for every dollar we paid, and today they're paying just 25 cents for every dollar that we're paying, talk about what effect that has had just on society and budgets overall, because that's a huge amount.
It is. Well, and I think you actually frame it quite well. There's two ways of thinking about the impact this shift has had on us. One is the dollars and cents shift. We know that when big corporations aren't paying, when Amazon isn't paying $1 billion that they should otherwise have paid, that $1 billion has to come from somewhere. Doesn't have to be tax increases. It could be spending cuts. And in fact, it's probably been a mix over time. But, you know, but it is a shift, and it's a shift that is on balance damaging, because middle income families do not have the capacity to handle this shift in general in the way that a profitable business does. And certainly on the spending side, when you look at the areas of public investment that we know need more resources rather than less, everything from healthcare to transportation to, well, some people say wall building even. You know, all these things, there is this demand for resources. And when big companies aren't paying these taxes, it's got to come out of these spending side programs in some way. The second, and so there's this long-term trend towards paying less for services, as Gene has already alluded to, and towards individuals and low-income individuals to boot making up the difference. So from a dollars and cents perspective, that's incredibly troubling. There's also, what worries me just as much, a sort of a democratic accountability problem, which is, I guess the way I'd say it is that, you know, by all accounts, 3 years ago, a bunch of people voted the way they did in the 2016 election because of this belief that the system is not there for them, that the system is tilted against them and is rigged in favor of big corporations and the best off. And when you see this shift that is ongoing and apparent by all appearances continuing right now, that really undermines the public's ability to believe that the system is there to support them. And, you know, I think you'd agree with me that right now we have a crisis of democratic legitimacy in the eye of a lot of people. And this continuing trend, this shift away from taxing big businesses and towards taxing individuals, cannot help that trend in the long run.
But let's talk about how these individuals are able to pay no taxes. Your organization, the ITEP, just put out a report called 60 Profitable Fortune 500 Companies Avoided All Federal Income Taxes in 2018. And the Center for Public Integrity teamed up with NBC to write a piece about this report, and it's called You Paid Taxes, These Corporations Didn't. About twice as many of the largest U.S. companies reported they did not pay any taxes in 2018 compared with previous years. So just a general question, Matt, how do companies get away with not paying any tax, federal income taxes at all? How does this work?
The first thing I'll say is that there is no indication whatsoever that the mechanisms these companies are using at this time are illegal. By all appearances, companies are using the tax breaks that Congress and a series of presidents have in a bipartisan way cheerfully ponied up over the last couple of decades. Congress has enacted tax cuts, and these companies are using them. Now, it's not that simple, and it's not all Congress's fault. In many cases, the corporate lobbyists wrote the tax laws, and now they're just abiding by them, but it was their idea to begin with. But that's an important observation. This is, I think, a potentially cheerful way of looking at it, though, because if it's the case, as we documented today, that these 60 companies are earning, you know, close to $80 billion of income and not paying any federal income taxes on it, it's because of a short list of tax breaks that we all can identify. Depreciation tax breaks that let companies write off the cost of their capital investments very quickly. Stock option tax benefits that let companies write off their executive stock options. Tax breaks for R&D, tax breaks for fossil fuels, tax breaks for not using fossil fuels. You know, it's a pretty clear list. And thanks to the reports we can get from the federal government, we know how much these tax breaks cost. So really, the good news is that it is very much within the power of Congress and the Trump administration to go after these tax breaks, make them more effective and less expensive, and make the taxes fair if they have the political will to do it.
And what would you add, Gene? When the Trump administration brought down the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%, I mean, that's earth-shattering news on its own. But as we are learning, and so many reports have come out over the years, many companies pay no taxes at all. So what would you add? How would you explain how they do this?
Well, before I get there, I do want to add this note. The danger of looking only to corporations is, even if you doubled the tax on corporations, you got rid of all these tax breaks, you're nowhere near to solving most of the problems of paying for even what we already get. You made reference to what we collected 50 years ago. So 1970, just about 50 years ago, corporate taxes were about 3% of GDP. So if that's something we wanted to go back to relative to what we're today, which is about half that, about 1.5, you'd get a significant amount of revenues, but that wouldn't even cover half the deficit, much less the cost of everything else. The bigger issue is who's going to pay for what we are basically giving ourselves, and when are we going to stop borrowing so much from abroad to pay for it? Now, it's the specifics of how corporations avoid taxes, and this is one of the difficulties and one of the reasons why even corporate reform was something that was promoted by the Obama administration, not just the recent Trump administration. The difference was the Obama administration would have paid for that corporate reform with other tax increases, such as individual taxes on people who made very high amounts of income. So what people who own capital income have been able to do over time, it's not just corporations, it's you and me. We were able to put our money into homes or to 401k accounts, and we don't pay taxes on the return. And there's also this ability to, with the technical terms, arbitrage the system, which means we take our deductions when we can get them, but we then accumulate our income in forms like in our retirement account, or for very wealthy individuals as accrued capital gains, and don't realize the income on the other end. Now, corporations play the same game, and they basically can say, well, you know what, I've got all these returns to buy investments, and a lot of the investments now are no longer plant and equipment that we can track, we know where they're located. A lot of those investments are now in research and human capital. Apple essentially owns physical capital these days anymore. It's all human capital. It's built into the software. They can move their company abroad. And so one reason that we tried to engage corporate reform, and I say both parties wanted to do it at some level, was to actually say, well, you know, we're just having trouble dealing with all this, and people are sheltering their income in havens abroad. We've inadequately tried to go after those havens. But even so, some of those efforts would be very hard to contain. So the bigger issue is who do we want to collect taxes from? And I would suggest that the corporation is often the collector. It collects for us in terms of as wage earners and salary and everything like that. But just talking about the corporate tax alone is not going to solve our various fiscal issues. And the danger of only talking about it is that it once again excuses us, the broad middle class who get most of government benefits and actually pay more taxes, to think that we don't have to do anything to solve our fiscal problems. That's the danger. Yes, we should do more with corporations, but don't think that's the answer to a lot of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely going to talk about state and local taxes also. And I think one of the reasons, I don't know if you agree with this, Gene, but one of the reasons why the corporate taxes get so much attention is because when you hear that, you know, a company like Amazon, for example, paid no federal income taxes on a record $11 billion in income last year, but you're, you know, having to write a $10,000 check to the IRS. I mean, it makes people pretty mad, especially when, you know, that $10,000 is a lot of money, and a lot of people are struggling just to make ends meet.
No, I agree perfectly with that. I mean, Matt made this point as well, that, you know, the impression of the system is being unfair. It is unfair on a whole variety in a whole variety of ways, and that actually then reduces support not just for government but for what it's doing, and people become cynical, and then often it becomes even harder to try to reach compromise to try to deal with our problems.
Right, and they also become very anti-tax, right? Right. We don't want to give the government our money because they don't spend it well. Well, let's just spend a minute, though, on the report that just came out. What really struck you the most, Matt? I mentioned Amazon and your report. According to your report, Amazon reported $11 billion of income and claimed a federal income tax rebate of $129 million. Netflix paid no federal income tax on $188 million. When reporters were publishing stories about the finding that Netflix paid no federal or state income taxes on $845 million in profits, they started hearing from Netflix's PR team, who claimed that was incorrect. So what are your thoughts? What really stood out for you?
First, on the Netflix thing, I'll go beyond mm-hmm. that. We've published detailed things on Amazon and Netflix and got sustained, pretty comprehensive pushback. I should say the media folks covering it did basically every time they wrote about it. The thing I would add to that is that the complaints that these two companies made about our calculations on these were basically content-free. In response to our finding that they paid no federal income tax, they would say, well, we did pay income taxes somewhere else in the world, or we will promise to pay income taxes at some point in the distant future, neither of which is really an effective riposte to the observation that you're paying nothing right now. In terms of surprises from the report, I can't say there were a whole lot. The only surprise, I would say, would be for those who took seriously the claims that were made by the authors of the tax bill. There were pretty concrete claims that this bill would pay for itself, that the economic growth unleashed by this corporate tax cut would result in a flow of new corporate tax revenue, and that's clearly not taken place. As you mentioned, the 30% decline we saw last year in corporate taxes is the biggest drop ever in a single year other than the Great Recession. So that's not panning out. But I guess in terms of the diversity of industries, maybe it's a surprise. Everything from these new tech companies to the old manufacturing standbys from the 80s, like GM and IBM. It's not one sector. It's not one area of economic activity. It's not one type of economic production. It does appear to be an epidemic of tax avoidance that spans the U.S. economy.
As the report points out, these companies actually are receiving a net corporate tax rebate. So instead of paying $16 billion in taxes, they're getting a rebate of $4
billion? That's correct. And it's important to know that we don't know exactly what form that takes. All we know is that the federal income tax liability is negative. As you know from sort of doing your taxes on the individual side, you can get a check back from the government, or you can apply this to future year taxes, and we don't really know what form it takes because we don't have access to the tax forms. What we do know is that the best estimate of what these companies are actually paying this year is a negative number, and that's pretty astounding. And when you have companies this big and this profitable that are able to do that, pretty clearly it has a measurable effect on the budgetary process. We're talking billions of dollars here, and that is billions of dollars that, as I've mentioned before, is going to have to be taken out of some spending program at some point. It's a big deal.
Matt Gardner is a senior fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, a nonprofit, nonpartisan tax policy organization. And you can find more information about this new report that just came out. 60 profitable Fortune 500 companies avoided all federal income taxes in 2018. They also have information about stock options and how, for example, Amazon reduced its income taxes by $1 billion using a tax break for stock options. Netflix, Salesforce, and other companies did the same thing. They've got information about fossil fuel tax subsidies, alternative energy tax subsidies, and tax credits. We're also joined today by Gene Sturley, Institute Fellow and Richard B. Fisher Chair and co-founder of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. And today on Your Call, since Monday is tax day, we decided to spend the hour taking a look at how the tax system has changed over the years, who actually pays what share, and later in the show, we'll talk talk about where the money goes. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss the rapidly unfolding situation in Sudan. After months of protests, Sudan's military stepped in and removed President Omar al-Bashir, but activists call the military takeover a coup that aims to reproduce the same faces that protesters revolted against. So what is next for Sudan? And then we will also talk about the links between climate change and the recent devastating flood that we're seeing here in the U.S. and around the globe. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you have any questions about taxes, we have two guests on who work extensively on these issues. Matt Gardner is senior fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. It's a nonpartisan tax policy organization. And Gene Sterley is Institute Fellow and Richard B. Fisher, Chair and co-founder of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you are affected by the Trump administration's tax law, let us know. And what are your thoughts just about how this very complex tax system works in this country? What changes would you like to see? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Gene, you wrote a piece on your blog, The Government We Deserve. You wrote that federal tax and spending policies are worsening the problem of economic inequality. You attribute this in part to tax breaks that overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy, but also to spending on programs that are supposed to support those who need it, but support consumption more than opportunity. So can you talk about how federal tax and spending policies contribute to growing inequality?
Yes, and I was particularly referring to wealth inequality, which is much worse than even than income inequality. So largely speaking, we have two sets of policies for the wealthy and then essentially for the non-wealthy in aggregate, with the biggest things that affect them. So for the wealthy, basically, we no longer really do much in taxing returns from capital. And I mentioned that's not just the very wealthy. We all have access to these various mechanisms, such as owning a home where we save the rent, but we don't count that as income, or we have money in a retirement account, and that's equivalent over time to not taxing the capital income, even though we'll eventually pay some on, eventually when we withdraw some of it. And for the very wealthy, they don't pay tax essentially often on their accumulated capital gains. So you take interest deductions as you go along in life, and you accumulate capital gains on your assets, including owners of the corporations that we've been talking about. And when you die, those capital gains are forgiven from tax. So that those policies have been largely what's been supporting the wealthy, and we've been moving along that track for a long time. There's a case to be made for not taxing capital income too high, because capital income does produce, at least provide some incentive for capital, which is an important ingredient in producing economic output, which eventually we wage earners earn from as well. So that's been the policy at the top. For most of the rest of us, the main subsidies that we get haven't been in that particular form. Most people don't have that much wealth, so even if they could take advantage of owning a home or having a retirement account, they don't have that much there that it makes a big difference. The huge subsidies on our end have largely gone towards consumption. And this gets a little tricky, but I'm distinguishing between those subsidies that support more consumption and those that actually provide opportunity. Opportunity projects are things like wage subsidies and educational subsidies, things like that. And those have really been going into a tailspin. Governments increasingly not supporting those particular types of policies, but they are continuing to increase support for consumption. And the biggest examples, this will be controversial to some of your readers, but if you look at the budget, a Trump budget or even the last Obama budget, you look out about 10 years from now, we're expected to collect about $1 trillion more in revenues. That's real dollars. There's no inflation in that. And $1.5 trillion of that has been committed. And it's all been committed partly to interest on the debt, because that grows when we don't collect enough taxes to pay our bills. But the other big items are basically Social Security and health. And health is largely Medicare. As much as I support Social Security and Medicare, to think that we should throw all of our increased revenues into those particular items and nothing into education and opportunity is silly, because those items, among other things, have now supported us retiring on average for about 13 more years than we did when 1940, when those systems were, Social Security was first created. That's both living longer and retiring earlier. So that's financing a lot more consumption. And again, it's fine to try. I want to support the elderly. I want to support those types of programs. I want to provide minimum levels of consumption. But I really worry about what's getting squeezed, and that's the squeeze on things that are actually building opportunity, long run, help us build up our own human resources, education, capital, ability to do things. And government is moving increasingly away from that. And as a result, by the way, of retiring for 13 more years, we save for fewer years, we work for fewer years, our savings goes down. Meanwhile, we're subsidizing the saving of the fairly wealthy who keep accumulating more income, and the wealth distribution gets worse. So it's not that we don't want to support people, but we really need to think carefully about how those supports apply. At the same time, we're trying to think about how much we should be taxing higher income or more wealthy people to support what they get out of the United States and this great economy as well.
And Gene, where would you say military spending, where would you put that? Because when we look at specifically weapons spending, we're hoping to be joined by someone from the National Priorities Project, and they just put out a new article, 24 cents out of every dollar of your taxes go to the military. Of those 24 cents, just 5 cents goes to the troops, while 12 cents goes to corporate military contractors. And Lindsay Koshargian points out that Lockheed Martin's CEO took home $20 million, while enlisted soldiers got just $20,000. And you know, the National Priorities Project puts out this graphic every year showing us how our money is actually spent. But what about that? 24 cents going to the military, 12 cents going to corporate contractors.
I don't know the percentages in terms of how the military budget is allocated. I do know that defense now comprises about 15% of total spending, which is, if you go back, say, after World War II, after the Korean War, it was well above 50 or 60. And that money has, that share has been going down in sort of a roller coaster ride downward over time, with pickups in Vietnam, then post-Vietnam declined significantly, then pickups in the Reagan administration. By the end of the Reagan administration, the percentage was back down almost to where it was. It's now about 3% of GDP, which you can compare to 14% of GDP post-Korean War. So, they're certainly, any big system spending that much money, there's a lot of room for reform. But I don't know how far I would say that defense is responsible for some of our fiscal issues. It's been a declining part of the budget for, let's say, in sort of a downward roller coaster ride, but for some time now. President Trump has proposed increasing it for the next couple years, but if you look 10 years out in terms of where it's projected to go as a share of GDP, it still would be going down unless those increases in the near term get added to as well.
So you're saying that as a percentage of GDP, it's going down, because I was under the impression that the military budget was going up since 9/11.
I keep mentioning this roller coaster ride that its long trajectory has been down, but occasionally it goes up before it goes back down on a down cycle. But it's now about as low, pretty much close to as a share of our economy, as low as it's been in the entire post-World War II era. But remember, we were fighting big wars before, and we've been fighting much more minor wars, however important they are, as well. The other issue here, which may come in here, is how much is starting to go to things like Homeland Security, which some people add and don't add. I'm just giving you the defense number.
Right, because I think that overall is about a trillion. Matt, do you look at these this number? Do you study this, the military budget?
Not in particular. I mean, for us, the really salient issue, and it's one that Gene has alluded to a couple of times already, is not so much the level of spending on military or on any other component on the spending side. It's how those aggregates add up relative to what our tax system is bringing in. And the thing we know is that we have not raised enough money to pay for our collective public investment needs in any single year since 2001. So, you know, you can certainly pin it on defense spending in part in the sense that it's taken away from priorities that most Americans would rather see. But the reason we're facing this sort of death match between the areas of public spending we all want to see, forget about the wall building thing or defense, is because there simply is not enough revenue, nowhere near, to go around right now to pay for all the public investments that everyone can agree are a good thing. That's the real crisis to me.
Rose, if I can throw this into some per household numbers, just roughly speaking, we're in a about a $20 trillion economy, government, if let's convert that per household basis, federal government spends about $32,000 a household in spending. That doesn't count tax subsidies, which we've talked about a little bit here as well. But our revenues are about $26,000 per household. So it's a pretty big gap. Or if you want the bigger numbers, the non-household, the GDP number, just the total numbers, is we have spent about $4 trillion in spending. We collect about $3.3 trillion in revenues. The other $665 billion comes out of borrowing, which is going up at a fairly rapid pace. That's just an annual number.
Thank you for that. Can we spend also some time talking about state and local tax systems? Matt, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy put together another very important report called Who Pays? A Distributional Analysis of the Tax Systems in All 50 States. And some of the main findings, the vast majority of state and local tax systems are inequitable and upside down, taking a much greater share of income from low and middle income families than from wealthy families. You also found that the lower one's income, the higher one's overall effective state and local tax rate. On average, the lowest income 20% of taxpayers face a state and local tax rate more than 50% higher than the top 1% of households. There are just so many bullet points in this important report. Can you summarize the findings that really stood out for you the most?
Sure. Well, you just said the best one, which is that we have an upside-down tax system at the state and local level. The more you earn, the less of your income you pay in state and local taxes. That is a cross-state regularity, almost without exception. It's worse in some places than in others, but it's basically true everywhere. And it's actually a pretty predictable product of the way state and local governments raise revenue. Historically, local governments have gotten all their money from property taxes, and property taxes tend to fall inevitably most heavily on low-income families, and to a lesser extent on middle and even lowest on upper-income families. The second leg of how state and local governments raise their money is sales taxes, which even more heavily fall disproportionately on the poorest families. The only tool state and local governments have for achieving even a modicum of fairness is the personal income tax, and state personal income taxes tend to be much smaller than at the federal level. That's why you have this system on the whole that makes poor people poorer and makes rich people richer. It's not a measure of tax fairness. It's not a vision of tax fairness, really, that any American would agree with on its face. It happens simply because state and local taxes just tend not to be on the radar of politicians when they talk about fairness at the national level. When you hear complaints about our tax system at the national level, it's usually just about, conveniently, just about the federal personal income tax. You know, you hear these stats about 45% of Americans not paying any taxes. The unseen modifiers there are federal personal income taxes. And at the same time, that's happening with this background of state and local taxes that are inexorably taking more than 10% of the income on average away from families living below the poverty line. State tax systems make poor people poorer.
Wow. Can you elaborate on this? Because as you said, this doesn't get talked about much. So I want to make sure we understand why and how this happens. In the report, you say that states commended as low tax are often high tax for low and middle income families. So we often hear, you know, from Texas politicians, Republicans, that people are leaving California to go to Texas because they don't pay as much in taxes. Your report says the 10 states with the highest taxes on the poor include Florida, Hawaii, Iowa, Oklahoma, and Texas. So tell us how this works.
Sure. Well, the decision to have a low tax state is usually a proxy for not, almost always a proxy for not having a personal income tax at all. It's true in Texas. It's true in Florida. It's true in New Hampshire, Alaska, a number of other states. And almost as inevitably, what that means is that to pay for needed services, whether it's schools or transportation, they're ratcheting up the other available taxes. And again, there's not a lot there. It's sales taxes or it's property taxes. And property taxes and sales taxes are inevitably harder on low-income families, harder on families below the poverty line, and indeed on middle-income families than the income taxes they're replacing. So, you know, it's viewed as a sort of a step away from a step towards fiscal sanity by people who say it's a good idea, but really it's a shell game. All it really is shifting away the cost of funding public services away from the people who have money toward people who don't. And it's a recipe for fiscal disaster, which is why you see the states without income taxes typically have not just low spending, but lousy outcomes on the spending side, terrible per pupil expenditures on the education side, bad roads, whatever measure of social outcomes. The low tax states tend to perform really poorly on these social outcomes as well.
Can I jump in here and distinguish between? I'm sorry. Whether taxes are low relative to benefits and whether they actually hurt the poor. Basically, even the most regressive tax, by regressive means that you might charge lower income people a higher share of their income, even the most regressive tax, usually, whether at the federal or the state level, if it's financing more spending, ends up being progressive overall. That may sound contradictory, but what I'm saying is, for instance, if you have $10,000 of income and pay 20% of your income in taxes, that's $2,000, and I have $100,000 and I pay only 10%, that's $10,000. Once that income gets split out and we all get sort of the same K-12 education or something like that, it actually redistributes. So one has to be a little careful when citing these numbers, because, and this is a technical point, but we discuss progressivity inconsistently when we talk about taxes and spending. With taxes, we usually talk about share of income that goes in taxes. With spending, we talk about whether you get more or less than I do. And so the reason I'm making this point is that one wants to avoid the distinction between what basically has been argued, that low tax states are providing lower services, and that's actually very true. But it doesn't mean it's because only they haven't taxed rich people. That means also that they usually tend to be low on other taxes that would be able to support the type of redistribution I was talking about. So as I say, even if you have a tax that taxes low-income people, same share of their income as high-income people, or even more, by the time you take into account the redistribution, if there's more of those taxes, you'll, generally speaking, have a more progressive system and be able to support a larger, say, K-12 educational system, which is where a very large proportion of state and local spending goes.
Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
I get the notion that and appreciate the notion that you have to think about both sides of the ledger. It's obviously pretty difficult with state and local public services, since it's difficult to know where that money's going. But you know, and I think as a baseline measure, and I know, Gene, you would agree with this, the main article of concern is just, are you raising money in a way that as a state that is designed almost to make poor people poor? It's cold comfort to low-income families whose, you know, sales taxes and property tax them, you know, push them below the poverty line, if some of that money is then going to fund schools. The bottom line is states are almost universally underusing their resources on the progressive end by undertaxing income, or in many cases not taxing income at all. And that could be done in a much more efficient way, in a much more sustainable way, that would lead to better spending outcomes across the nation.
Right, and I don't disagree. I'm just repeating a point actually I made at the very beginning, which is that I worry about discussions about whether taxes should be more progressive and higher income people paying more. And as I say, I've even written in favor of such things as taxing capital gains at death, so I'm not opposed to thinking about that. I always worry that that message comes across as, oh, we in the middle class don't have to pay for government because somebody else out there is getting off the hook. And that's the part of the message I worry about. I don't think you disagree with that.
Absolutely not. And, you know, it's sort of the danger with taking the progressive argument too far. If, you know, the single thing everyone supports and always has supported is increasing taxes on big profitable corporations, right? I mean, that's a universal. If that is a substitute for acknowledging the responsibility people face at all income levels, then that's a lousy recipe for fiscal policy. It's important to have an organic view of what everyone ought to pay and not just focus it simply on big corporations ought to pay more. So right there with you on that.
And earlier in the show, we talked about what we have seen over the decades, the shift from taxes away from businesses onto individuals. What changes have we seen over the decades when you look at state and local taxes, Matt? I mean, the report that you all put together saying that the vast majority of these state and local tax systems are inequitable and upside down, is this fairly new, or has this been the case for many, many years?
There have been a lot of changes, but I think that overall picture has not changed much. A couple interesting things are happening. One, there are very few progressive elements to state taxes. One, the corporate income tax has been declining, if anything, even more rapidly at the state level than it has at the federal level, because instead of one set of policymakers enacting poorly thought out tax breaks, you now have two, with the state lawmakers doing the same thing. Estate taxes have not completely but partially vanished as a part of the state tax landscape. So that's two progressive tools that have disappeared. At the other end of the spectrum, there are some taxes that are clearly regressive in their impact, falling heavily on low-income families, that are in decline. Sales taxes, for example, because sales taxes tend to apply primarily to the physical things we buy and not to the intangible services we buy over the internet, those have been in decline over a long period of time. And gas taxes, cigarette taxes, because they're based on how many of a thing you buy, how many gallons of gas or how many packs of cigarettes or how many six packs of beer you buy, not based on inflation, those have been going down as well. So that's been sort of a long-term drain on these regressive taxes. Put these things together, and I think you still have sort of a uniform over time picture where states are leaning far more heavily on low-income people than on anybody else to fund public services.
Well, now I would like to bring in Lindsay Kashgarian to the show. Lindsay is Program Director at the National Priorities Project. Hi, Lindsay. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, we were hoping to get you a little earlier, but we only have about 2 minutes, but I still think it's important because the National Priorities Project does really amazing work looking at how our tax dollars are actually spent. So what stands out for you? Just a couple examples. The healthcare portion of a tax dollar is split almost equally. Medicare, 11.4 cents. Medicaid, 12.9 cents. 6 cents to veterans, 11 cents military contractors. What really stands out for you, Lindsay?
So what really stands out for me is a couple of things. For one, like you said, Medicaid and Medicare are a big part of our budget, and they insure one in three Americans. So those are, you know, really important, amazing programs, and they do cost a lot, but we're getting an awful lot for that money. Another thing that stands out for me is the amount of money that we're spending on the Pentagon. So the average American is spending about $14,000 on all federal income taxes. And out of that, about $3,400 is going to the Pentagon, But what's really striking about that is where that money is actually going. More than half of it is going to military contractors. And when we think about military spending in the Pentagon, we probably, a lot of us think about the troops, and think about supporting the troops. But it's actually only about 5 cents out of every dollar that actually goes to the troops in forms of pay and housing and other things that support them. And so they're getting far less than half of what military contractors are getting out of the Pentagon budget. And the contractors really just kind of have the run of the place. So it's a pretty big deal that's where so much of our tax money is going. And then when you look at the third item, it's interest on the debt. And so when you think about what's driving that interest, paying off all of those military contractors is a big part of that.
I was struck by a piece you just wrote, Lindsay, for military contractors, tax day is payday. You point out that Lockheed Martin's CEO took home $20 million, while enlisted soldiers got just $20,000. And you also cite, is this true, 1.7 cents of every tax dollar goes to the Pentagon's biggest contractor and maker of the F-35, Lockheed Martin?
That is true. Almost 2 pennies out of every tax dollar is going to one single corporation.
Well, Lindsay, I'm sorry we connected with you so late. We're out of time, but we'd love to have you back to talk about where our tax dollars go. And we have about 30 seconds, and I don't want to end the show without saying, Matt, what can people do to try to reform the system?
The good news is the path to reform is exactly the same as the path Congress chose not to take in 2017. Look for the loopholes, ask whether they work, and repeal them if they do not work. Get to a place where we're taxing all corporate income the same way.
Matt Gardner is Senior Fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Matt, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Gene Sterley is Institute Fellow and co-founder of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Gene, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. And Lindsay Kashgarian is Program Director at the National Priorities Project. Lindsay, we'd love to have you back. Thanks so much for your work, and thanks for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.